How important are memories in defining who we are? And how hard do we work to remember our past or forget it? The book Jim Crow Wisdom looks at stories told by Black Americans about their past, and it examines how these stories help us understand modern Black identity. Yale history professor Jonathan Holloway wrote the book as both a scholar and a man trying to look more honestly at the story of himself and his own family. He talks about Jim Crow Wisdom next Thursday at Hayti Heritage Center here in Durham, but he joins us today. Jonathan Holloway, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about how you decided to write the book.
Well, I sort of came to the first-person involvement sort of backwards. I planned to write a third-person history looking at how people told stories along the lines you just mentioned about their past and why it mattered for the present. But the more I kept running into stories of, say, Langston Hughes getting kicked off a trolley car in the 1940s, I remembered, wait, that's the story my uncle told me about his experience in the 50s. And someone else having a story about the 1960s, like, that's the story my parents told me in the 70s. And then the more I got into this research, the more I kept discovering that my own family history was lined up very neatly with all these other histories of other people I was writing about. And so I finally gave myself permission to weave in a first-person voice into this more traditional third-person history.
And tell us about some of the more standout experiences when you read you were reading essays in Negro Digest, right?
Yes, that was actually where it all started. There was a magazine called Negro Digest, essentially the Black version of Reader's Digest, started in the early 1940s. And there was a series called My Most Humiliating Jim Crow Experience. It's a striking title. And there are these two-page long vignettes. And it ran for about 4 years, this series. And I stumbled across that series and kept wondering, why would somebody tell these stories of such racial shame and humiliation? And that's when I started noticing that, you know, these are stories from the 1940s, and yet they lined up so neatly with other stories from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 90s, and so forth. And I found that surprising in the sense that there's been so many radical changes on the legal and political front as far as civil rights and voting rights, et cetera, and yet certain narratives or motifs in how Blacks tell the story of their past have remained constant. Now, part of the answer is racism is alive and well, and so that's the easier answer. But I thought it was much more complicated than that, and that's what really set me off on my journey.
Tell us about the title itself, Jim Crow Wisdom.
Oh, it's a harrowing story. The great writer Richard Wright, author of Native Son in the early 1940s, wrote a short story, Ethics of Living Jim Crow, in the late 1930s, telling a story of his childhood and getting into fights with the white boys literally across the tracks, because that's just what boys did. And then one day he really loses badly and gets sent to the hospital. And he's waiting on the front stoop for his mother to come home after he's been stitched up. And he wants his mother to exact justice for him. And he tells her what had happened and why things weren't fair. And she drags him into the house, pulls out a barrel stave, and starts to beat him. And he writes, the older Richard Wright writes of this experience, with each blow of the barrel stave, she beat into me another gem of Jim Crow wisdom. Mm-hmm. It's a horrific image. And basically, Mrs. Wright was trying to beat into her son some way to, her knowledge of the past and the way the system wasn't fair so that he could actually survive right. For the future.
How to navigate this system. So your
exactly.
Book then begins with a moment of your own family history. Tell us about your Aunt Maggie.
So, yeah, this is it's quite a story. My brother is the family historian of my generation. I'm the youngest of three, and Aunt Maggie was the oldest surviving member on my father's side of the family, and she's one of these people who knew the family history. So he went to go see her, and she was then in an assisted living facility, and she had her good days and her bad days, but this was a really great day. She was really lucid, and she did have the family memory. So he went to ask her a whole range of things, but there was one question he really wanted to ask. And he finally had warmed her up, essentially, and then finally got to the question, Aunt Maggie, you are the last person in our family who has any living memory of those people in our family who were slaves. Tell us about those people. And her whole demeanor changed immediately. And she said, there are some stories that are too painful to pass on. Those stories will die with me, and we don't talk about that in this family. And then she immediately turned away from him. I mean, literally turned herself away from him, stared off into the distance, and refused to acknowledge his existence until he left. Mm. And 3 months later, she died. And she followed through on her promise. We don't know that part of our family history. It's simply gone.
And I've also heard that not only are stories like that painful, and this may get to, again, the point of your book, sometimes those stories, when they're painful, aren't conveyed out of a sense of preservation. If I engender in you too much anger about these white people, you won't be able to survive. Is that part of the reason that people don't pass on the narrative?
I think that's exactly right. In my Aunt Maggie's case, she was someone who was really quite personally accomplished as a black woman in particular. And she was quite focused on pulling her family up from a very poor agricultural background into a very established middle class or maybe even upper middle class background. And so she was very status oriented, very status conscious. And she really looked down her nose, frankly, at those who did not aspire to her worldview. And so if she, in her worldview, to acknowledge the people who had been subjected, who had been slaves, that would diminish her family in her vision. I think that's fundamentally wrong. But it's not an unusual ideology. And it's not just an African-American story in this regard, but it's an immigrant story. It's a Holocaust survivor story. It's like these are some things are so terrible, we would not want to talk about them because we don't want to diminish our future.
You talk about another moment of discovery that you had when you found a letter in a box of belongings. Tell us about that.
I'll be happy to. So I teach a lecture course every spring on post-emancipation African-American history. And through a whole series of events, I get to know one of my teaching assistants. He and I had shared a background in Montgomery, Alabama. And I started talking to my older siblings and my father just about a series of coincidences that my TA and I had in terms of where we had grown up. And all of a sudden, I start discovering things. I was 5 and 6 years old in Alabama, and I started discovering things from my siblings and from my father that I never knew, that my experiences in Alabama were like of a hamster that didn't live long enough and going to the candy store. My brother and sister had experiences that were really quite challenging reflecting the racial dynamics of the early 1970s. And so I started getting curious about what else about my family do I not know? And here I am, a historian writing a book about memory and history and discovering that I just had a different kind of sets of memories. And one day I finally screwed up the courage to open up a box. It was of my brother had divided up some of my mother's remains for each of the children. And I decided to look in this box, this family history, and discovered, you know, report cards and art products my mother kept. But then I came across a letter that I'd never seen before. And it's a letter dated July 4th, 1968, and it starts, "Dear Son." I mean, July 4th, Independence Day, 1968, a very challenging year across the globe, frankly, but especially in terms of civil rights. And if I may, I want to read just the last two paragraphs from the letter.
Please do, yeah.
And it says here, so the letter is, "Dear Son. Son, I'm here being Vietnam. I'm here because I belong here. The black people of America have been there during all of the many crises that have faced this most magnificent, most lovely, most confusing country. We have shared these crises with our blood and our strength. It is our continuing heritage to be a part of the building of America and a part of her strength. We must share in her hope of freedom for all men everywhere. I believe that through my sacrifices this year, I can guarantee a little better chance for you to realize the full benefits of a free country. Just as I eagerly joined in the fight for the right to vote, to have a chance to cast my free ballot freely, so too must I fight for the right of other men to cast their ballot. And son, the thousands of other black men here realize too that this fight for a free ballot is equally a fight for a free country. To fight for one, you fight for the other. Guarantee one, and you guarantee the other. We know that the sound of free ballots being cast is the beautiful sound of freedom that we so want for our children and the children of all people wherever they might live. You must realize the sacrifice you're making in having your dad away, and the sacrifices of the thousands of other black men and white men are forcing the dream of freedom forward. Yours in love and understanding, Dad." Now, when I finished reading this letter, I immediately started wondering who wrote it. And I actually went to Google and started entering different key phrases, trying to find who was the author of this really incredible letter, only to realize after nothing came up, like, my goodness, my father actually wrote this letter to my older brother. both my older brother and father sort of recollected, yeah, that sort of sounds like a familiar letter. But what I was left with is that here was a father I never knew. I mean, a father I knew quite well, but not this father. Here was sort of a patriotic and also racial militant at the same time and found a way to weave those two logics together. I never heard my father talk about these experiences at all. And so it was a really fascinating moment when the professional historian who's actually mining his own past is discovering he doesn't know his family history, even though he's writing about it.
I can imagine that must be a startling moment and a difficult moment for a historian. You know, what is this history? How much is forgotten and how much of the forgotten past, you know, needs to be added to the public record?
It was very humbling.
This book also tries to balance a desire, you say, for the tales of exceptionalism with the tales of reality. Tell us about that.
Well, so as a historian who teaches the post-emancipation survey, one of the highlights of the course is that moment you get to the civil rights movement. I mean, this is something that, you know, we as citizens hear quite a bit about, and it's a story of incredible events and heroic individuals, and all that's really quite true. But that's really only part of the story. And I think, you know, growing up in elementary school and junior high school and so forth, I was certainly always trained to think of the great figures like the Kings and the Rosa Parks as these heroes in a very, frankly, two-dimensional way. What I think now that I'm have a more mature sense of history is that there are millions of other people who are doing small daily things to survive, and they necessarily weren't at every march or at any march. They might have opened up their pocketbooks to send some money along, or they might have simply just been trying to find a way to make a way forward. And we need to know their histories as well. In fact, my biggest goal as a historian is to try to find a way for all of us to recognize that we're all saints and we're all sinners at the same time. And we aren't doing ourselves any good if we only talk about ourselves as saints. What I think makes this country exceptional is that it survives the way that it does despite all of its incredible challenges. Let's talk about those challenges. Let's talk about those difficulties, and I think we become a better place.
Is there a way to create the volume of American history, or is it – do we have to do the hard work of finding, digging out all of these narratives and stitching them together in our own heads and saying this is the blend that has made us who we are?
It is hard work. I mean, I'd love to say that there was one little pill we could take and it'd all be better, but it's simply hard work. It means that historians have to look at the archives in newly creative ways and recognize the archives only tell part of the story. It means that historians, people who aren't professional historians, need to talk to their families and be willing to discover those stories that they sort of knew, that they didn't know at all, and find how that colors and shapes a larger understanding of the world itself. I mean, this is a complex world, and it's going to resist any sort of complex rendering, but we have to do that hard work. I think it's really the only ethical way forward to build a really functioning, highly functioning democracy.
Well, thank you for your contribution. Professor Holloway, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Yale professor Jonathan Holloway and his book, Jim Crow Wisdom. He's going to be talking about the book Thursday, April 3rd at the Haytai Heritage Center right here in Durham. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a Syrian pianist who studied here in North Carolina returns to play the world's oldest written music. Stay with us.